Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Dr. Harold Smith, who is Distinguished Visiting Scholar and Professor with the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, where he focuses on the impact of technology on foreign and defense policy. From 1993 to 1998, Dr. Smith was Assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs. He is a Fellow of the American Physical Society and a Commander in the Legion of Honor of France. He has three times received the highest honor granted by the Department of Defense for Civilian Service, the Distinguished Public Service Award, as well as the Director's Award of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Exceptional Civilian Service Award of the Air Force, and the commendation of the Secretary of the Navy. His publications appear regularly in journals focused on national security and foreign policy. Harold, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And then my parents moved to Pittsburgh, so I grew up just north of Pittsburgh.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, you have to remember, my father was a graduate of Harvard in 1932, and that was, of course, the Depression was in hard upon us at the time. As a Harvard graduate, he, of course, expected the world to treat him accordingly, and it didn't. There were no jobs. He finally found a job in Pittsburgh, and that's where he stayed. It's a comment on that generation that he would never take another job. He just could not leave the one he had for fear that there would not be another job. His son, namely me, of course, I grew up in the boom times. And the idea of quitting the gas station to take on some other job midsummer worried him enormously. But of course, it didn't bother me because they were boom times. It was that kind of tension, though, that made for a very interesting childhood, where my modern ways and his depression ways really provided a nice basis for conversation between the two of us for many years.
What got you interested in the sciences?
I think, Harry, that's genetic. One is born with those genes, and I was. I loved mathematics as far back as I can remember. And I haven't lost that love yet.
And so where did you pursue your education?
At MIT. And that in itself was a wonderful comment on the United States. I was the first of a group of about a dozen Sloan National Scholars. Alfred Sloan had made scholarships available at MIT and three other institutions. And they were very generous, wholly for academic effort, but they paid everything, tuition, expenses, and I had no choice but to go to MIT, even though my father would mention Harvard from time to time.
He wanted a job.
That's right. But Harvard didn't offer that kind of a scholarship. MIT did. And MIT met with my genetic makeup. I really wanted to study science, and so I did.
And did you do your undergraduate work at MIT, too? Or?
Yeah. All of my degrees are MIT. One, I guess, should go elsewhere for graduate school, but if one's already at what I think is one of the world's finest institutes, and it happens to be in Boston, and you know where all the girls' schools are, well, why leave? So I didn't.
That's good. And so what, when you were there, what degree did you pursue?
Well, because I was a Sloan Scholar, I started off as a business major. I was going to be a captain of industry. Well, I soon learned that mathematics, physics, chemistry, thermodynamics, that was easy. What was hard was marketing, accounting, and well, this isn't for me. So I left to study physics, but the best I could do and graduate in 4 years was to study a physics option in mechanical engineering. So my first degree was mechanical engineering, and then nuclear engineering fellowships were offered. I was awarded those, one of those. And studied nuclear engineering, which is a heavy input of physics. So you might say I've been pursuing physics through the world of engineering my entire life. Mm-hmm. As you know, my publications tend to be more in physics than in engineering.
And what sort of problems in nuclear physics interested you in your early career, in your early scholarship?
Well, Harry, thank you. I haven't thought about that in a long time. The one I enjoyed the most is called the xenon poisoning problem. It involves a set of differential equations, and one has to invoke, to solve this particular problem, the theorems of Pontryagin, a blind Russian mathematician. And that served me well, as I hope we'll discuss later in my tours of Russia. But solving that problem brought me considerable fame in the academic sense, and I think was probably the most rewarding piece of work I did. To put it in a historical context, in the Manhattan Project, the Hanford reactors, shortly after they were started, shut down. And Wigner had designed the reactors, and Wigner and Fermi figured out what had happened, and it has to do with large cross-sections and radioactive decay and the times involved. What I did was optimize that situation, whereas the real credit, of course, goes to Fermi and Wigner. They recognized the problem and solved it in a very straightforward mechanical way that worked. Later on, 30 years later, we now know how to do that slightly better thanks to the work I did here at Berkeley.
And you came to Berkeley, so you were actually on the faculty here in a program called Applied Science, or were you
No, this was the Department of Nuclear Engineering.
Okay, good.
And it's a compliment to Berkeley. I had been offered an appointment at MIT, and I said no, contrary to my decision between graduate and undergraduate. I said, no, it is time for me to try something else, but I will be back. And then as I drove this old Mercury around the bend where suddenly all of San Francisco Bay comes into view, I remember saying to myself, I'm never going back. And you know what? I didn't.
That's right. That first drive, I was originally from Texas, and that first drive when you approach the West Coast is really quite stunning.
Now, to be a little less frivolous, when I arrived at Berkeley, I found on my desk a telephone, and that telephone connected me with every expert in any field I could have the least possible interest. Mm-hmm. That was new, and that speaks very well for the diversity of this campus. As a young professor, I would call young professors in history of a period I wanted to read, and I would ask them, what do you recommend for the casual reader? And they would give me a set of books, suggest lunch in a month, and I would say no, but I'd read the books. And of course, I'd close the conversation by saying, and if you need any recommendations for casual reading in quantum mechanics, I'm your man, call me. But Berkeley's diversity really, really impressed me then, and it impresses me now.
This is a theme that we'll talk about later in some of your current work, but namely the interdisciplinary environment. One needs to research a lot of problems, and of course Berkeley is an ideal place for doing that. So that, and you're here, you're not just talking about the array of talent in the sciences, but also in the social sciences.
Very definitely.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I didn't go back.
I like to ask my guests the following question. If a student were watching this program, and let's talk about your work thus far in nuclear engineering, what is it, what are the skills that one needs to do the work we're talking about here in nuclear engineering, and what are the qualities of character that you think are conducive to getting the job done in a field like nuclear engineering?
Well, let me answer the second question first.
Yeah.
Nuclear power in this country has been in decline for 20 years, right after Three Mile Island, and of course Chernobyl, might have put the nail in the coffin. So tenacity is certainly needed by nuclear engineers here in the United States, not in France, etc. But the world moves on. The demand for oil is going up. Concerns for global warming are becoming ever more powerful in their arguments. I think it's inevitable that the United States will have to turn to nuclear power. Not everyone agrees with me, of course, But I've had, as you noted in your introduction of me, I've had considerable work with the French. And I have seen there a country that has 80% of its electricity generated by nuclear power, and they do it very, very well. Can we compete, as China now says it's going to build nuclear reactors, India is going to build nuclear reactors? It'll be interesting to see who wins these competitions. Will it be the former Westinghouse, or will it be Areva, the French company? But to answer your question, one has to believe that the world is going to need this form of power, and I think it's justified. Mm-hmm. But tenacity is certainly one character trait that is necessary. To carry out the field, I think it's more sophisticated because of its heavy involvement in nuclear physics. So you do need a wonderful grounding in nuclear physics, and in my particular case, the applied mathematics that allows you to understand how to do these types of calculations to carry out the designs.
Early in your career, you went to Washington, and in a way, I guess we can say you stayed there, although you always wanted to come back here, and finally you have. You were a White House fellow, and you worked as an assistant to then Secretary of Defense McNamara. Did your academic career as an engineer prepare you for Washington and that kind of work?
Nothing can compare one for Washington. In fact, just to tell a short anecdote, somebody asked Ronald Reagan, how can you be an actor and be President of the United States? Mr. Reagan's answer was quite proper. He said, to be President of the United States, you have to be an actor. But at any rate, nothing really prepares one for Washington, which was why I was so pleased to get the White House Fellowship. And I had asked for assignment to Robert McNamara because his career up to that point had been truly stunning. So I was happy to go.
And what kind of work did you do for him? Nuclear planning or?
Remember, that was the era when strategic planning, particularly with nuclear weapons, was very much in vogue. Albert Wohlstetter was the leader of that group. What McNamara and his director of defense research and engineering, you might say his top engineer, wanted me to do was to see if we could take strategic thinking a la the nuclear game, the strategic game, and apply it to tactical warfare. And that meant dealing heavily with what was going wrong with Vietnam at the time. I did do some very fine papers for Johnny Foster, and Mr. McNamara appreciated what I did, but the price I paid was enormous insight into what was going wrong in Vietnam. And watching two fine people, Mr. McNamara and Dr. Foster, trying to find a way to win the war and yet treat the situation as it deserved to be treated. It was a period of very high tension. Mm-hmm. Good experience.
What you just talked about and this movement to Washington gives us an opportunity to talk about a problem that you seem to have grappled with throughout your career, namely the adaptation of technology to the problem of national security, the management of that process, the thinking through of that process, and the control of that process. Talk a little about that, because that seems to be a theme that runs throughout your career in Washington.
You're very perceptive, Dr. Kreisler. Yeah. Very perceptive. Yes, it does. Just to give a few vignettes, during my early years on the campus, of course, I was heavily involved in technology, but because of my Washington experience, I knew how some of those technologies would play in the political arena. And so at that time on the campus was a professor named Aaron Voldovsky. Mm-hmm. And I would conjure up problems where new developments in technology were going to lead to new political strains in Washington or perhaps in the world. And I would go see Aaron. And I must say, he would resolve the political aspects of the questions with dispatch. Aaron has since died, but his legacy lives on in the Goldman School of Public Policy, which is why I am so pleased to be there. But you've put your finger on it. I like to be absolutely up to date on where technology is going, and then to try to think through what is that going to do. And I suppose the best example of that is Oppenheimer at the Trinity test in Alamogordo made the quote, "Physicists have known sin." And that was the beginning, I think, of scientists and engineers realizing that what we're doing has enormous effect, good and bad. And I find that endlessly fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So. And what, help us get into the complexity of the problem. Is it that the implications of the technology cannot always be seen? Is that a piece of this? Is it the human organizations that have to integrate the technology into whatever the existing routine? It seems like really a kind of an interdisciplinary problem.
Well, it is. Remember when Teller was advocating the hydrogen bomb, and Oppenheimer opposed him. And yet the pool of engineering and scientific accomplishments can be so great that when Edward Teller presented to Oppenheimer his idea for how you make a thermonuclear explosion, Oppenheimer was quite intrigued. He was captured by the ingeniousness of Teller's idea.
Elegance, isn't that?
Elegance is a very good word.
Yeah.
Very good word. And the United States then pursued, of course, the hydrogen, not as a result just of that, but the United States did pursue a hydrogen bomb program, and we only tested a weapon less than a year earlier than the Russians. Well, that's an extreme example of where technological push led to very key decisions. I don't think the Cold War would have gone as it did with the Russians having a thermonuclear weapon, the United States not. One can debate that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's trying to look ahead into that fog to see where the almost inevitable press of technology will take us. And of course, today, discovery of DNA is wonderful, but it also leads to the genetic engineering mm-hmm. of bioweapons. And how do you foresee those coming? Can we take steps now that will allow the good side of technology to benefit mankind, and the bad side to at least not destroy us?
You've worked in really all sectors. You've been in the academy. You've been in the private sector. You've been in the military, not necessarily as a soldier, but as a Pentagon official. What is the ideal synergy between these sectors? Is there one, or do they each contribute something different to the mix?
It's a good question. I think I've been driven by one other goal. Well, you've covered the first, that is my love of technology and where it plays. But there's another goal, and that is trying to answer the question, now just where are the smart guys? And I presume they're here at Berkeley when I came in the 60s, and there are. There are very smart people here, but not smart enough to hold me. Then I tried the world of business, particularly aerospace, companies like Boeing and Lockheed that are capable of building machines that we couldn't even imagine 10 years before the machine appeared, 747, satellites, whatever you like. So I look for the smart guys there. They're smart people, but there is certainly no monopoly. Then I tried the entrepreneurial world. I actually built a company that sold services on Wall Street, and I worked in the world of investment bankers, and there are smart people there. I was a soldier, as it turns out. I rose to the high rank of first lieutenant in the United States Army, and even there I had interesting assignments, but I didn't want to stay in the military. And then, of course, I went to government thanks to Secretary Perry. And there are smart people there, but they are nowhere and everywhere. I've been looking for almost mm-hmm. a lifetime now, and the fact that I'm back at Berkeley tells you that I think the faculty is probably the place where you're most likely to find the most interesting people to think about the things I enjoy thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, but it suggests that you're in a unique position to provide linkages, because it must be the case that each one of the sectors is doing something that is a kind of an insight that isn't the routine of the other sector.
That's a very perceptive point, and yes, that's exactly right. And I do have the love, probably the ability, to synergize these various experiences and put them together into hopefully a useful approach to something of importance to the society.
You mentioned nuclear power and the controversy over its use, its decline in the United States. Because another thing, once you're off to Washington, you must have really experienced all this organization, thinking about the integration of technology. It happens in this vigorous democracy. Which can partly help us understand why nuclear power was in decline, because there was a fear that that it posed a great danger. Do you have any comments or insights about how the work of democracy complicates the set of problems that you've been dealing with, both in a positive and a negative way?
Well, First of all, I agree with Winston Churchill. Democracy is terrible, but there's no better way. Mm-hmm. Yes, our democratic society was unable to accept nuclear power for reasons that have a lot to do with our free press and the way we read about Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. But I wouldn't have it otherwise. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, on the engineer's side, we had thought that nuclear power would be so cheap we wouldn't even bother to meter it. Well, it's now it has become competitive, and it can compete with coal, provided coal has to make sure that it doesn't pollute the atmosphere and the landscape. But it's competitive, but you might say just barely so. So we misled ourselves into just how economically feasible it was. And we failed to solve the waste problem early. And even now, the United States has not solved the waste problem. But the French probably have. They have a better approach. Now, there, of course, the French are a much tighter society. Napoleon had his effect. The bureaucracy really does what it's told in France. Here, the bureaucracy, the people, the parties, the press, we all have our different points of view. And if there's a concern such as the disposal of nuclear waste, then it's going to have a hard time in a democracy. Eventually, though, and I think it's going to happen, mm-hmm. we as a people do figure it out, and I think we do the right things. But it can be a painful process getting there.
Mm-hmm. Your career, if one looks at the span we're talking about, the relation of the Pentagon to the economy has changed over time. I mean, at one point, it seemed to be much clearer that the relationship was one which had an overall beneficial effect on the economy. One thinks of DARPA. One thinks of something like the Internet. We're going on the World Wide Web because of choices that DARPA made many years ago. Do you still think that synergy works, or are there things that we have to do to make it work better, or are we in a new era where consumer economics is more important?
I think it's a new era. The Office of Naval Research, DARPA, that's what sustained the marvelous research of the United States in the 60s and 70s. And of course, NASA was a big effect. Most of my work here on the campus in the 60s and 70s was supported handsomely by NASA. But to come to your direct question, let's say in the 70s, the defense research drove the research and development in the United States, and we have the benefit. The Internet is certainly a good example. Today, in the areas where I really think I understand the situation, it's the opposite. For example, the chip. The consumer demand for chips makes the Pentagon just a minor player. And yet the chips that we put into satellites, we would like to make sure that those chips can withstand a nuclear explosion in space. But we can't afford to build those kinds of chips. Nor should we. We'll have to find more clever ways to make sure that those satellites can withstand a nuclear explosion. In the world of bio, the military is not the major player. Of course, the biotech industry is. So I do think that in key areas, the roles have reversed. Now the military has to adapt to what the civilian economy produces and not vice versa.
Mm-hmm. And has this changed the way you think about some of the problems that you think about? General question, maybe too vague, but I mean, does it affect decisively the way you pose solutions to problems?
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. A quarter century ago, we would give this problem, whatever it may be, to the RAND Corporation to mm-hmm. see where we should go. We would then give contracts to the defense contractors and get what we wanted. Can't do that today. Mm-hmm. Many industries are moving so fast that we can't even predict where they'll be, let alone hand out contracts. So we have to wait and see what, I shouldn't say we, the military has to wait and see what the consumer industry produces and then act accordingly.
There
are exceptions, of course. So far, Boeing has not decided to build a stealth transport. So there are some technologies which are truly military, and they will presumably stay that way.
You began your career working with Secretary McNamara. In the middle of your career, you worked with Secretary of Defense Schlesinger. Most recently, you've worked with Secretary of Defense Perry. Talk a little about that role in your perception of it, because it seems to be somebody in the hot seat bringing all this together to ensure the national security of the country.
It's a very vague question here.
Okay.
Talk about some traits that they all have in common. Perry, Schlesinger, and McNamara, all highly intelligent, all articulate, interestingly enough, in different ways. Mr. McNamara speaks very precisely, almost forcefully. Secretary Perry is always accurate, but he is very sincere and soft-spoken. And Mr. Schlesinger is somewhere in between. But the ability to articulate the high intelligence that they all had is absolutely key. There are differences in the sense that Mr. McNamara really felt he was boss and didn't want to rely very heavily on the military. Mr. Rumsfeld, I think, is much the same way. Secretary Perry was just the opposite. Bill knew that to get something done in the Pentagon, you really have to get the services behind you. And he used all the charm that he has, which is considerable, to carry that out. So the Perry mode of operation was obviously quite different than the McNamara mode. McNamara operated from the top down, and he had some very able people to carry out his thoughts and to produce thoughts that he wanted carried out. Secretary Perry was much more diplomatic and getting people to agree that this is what we should do. All in all, I think Secretary Perry's approach is the one that works best in the bureaucracy, not just the Pentagon.
After the fall of the Soviet Union, a whole new set of tasks emerged, both for our national security, for the Pentagon, and for you, in the sense that they became part of your agenda. Talk a little about that. In other words, once the wall fell and the Soviet Union was no more, help us understand one subset of problems that emerged with regard to nuclear weapons and that resulted in Nunn-Lugar.
Well, it was one of the most wonderful revolutions that had ever taken place. suddenly Russia and the United States were had common, very common interests. We had nuclear arsenals that were way out of proportion. And the Russians didn't have the economy to take care of them. And so, of course, the Nunn-Lugar bill was passed, and it fell to me to manage that program. And that was exciting, because suddenly we, the Americans, were helping our former enemies, who could have destroyed us, to dismantle the very arsenal that could have destroyed us. It is rare in history that one ever gets that kind of opportunity. As an example, the Ukraine had a lot of nuclear weapons. And we and the Russians had to work very hard, hard negotiations, hard deals, hard technology, to get those weapons, by agreement with the Ukraine, out of Ukraine, and to safe storage sites in Russia without any accidents and fully accounted. We did that. So you might say we denuked the Ukraine. We also denuked Belarus and Kazakhstan. That is an accomplishment of the first magnitude.
Is this an example of reverse engineering, where something has been put in place and your knowledge really about, at least on the technical side, facilitates doing the reverse?
No, that's too grandiose.
Okay.
Believe me, it is much easier to destroy a missile than it is to build a missile.
Yeah.
So no, you don't want to... You're pushing the metaphor too far.
Okay. Now let's get very specific here. So Nunn-Lugar put up the funding and created the program, which you were then asked to head under reporting directly to Secretary Perry. Now you're immediately in a jungle of American bureaucracy, American politics, Russian politics, Russian bureaucracy. Walk us through that. In other words, what did you suddenly confront in the way of obstacles on the American side for something that, as a program, one would think everyone would agree with?
Good question. And I will try to handle it on both sides. That is an American dilemma and a Russian dilemma. The American dilemma: the Nunn-Lugar bill was passed in 1991, but it was only authorized. No money was appropriated. And therefore, the Bush administration, Bush 1, if they wanted to implement the program, which was authorized, they had to find funds elsewhere. And when the wall went down, the number of places where the Pentagon felt it should put its money were just legion. And so it was quite easy for the Bush administration or Secretary Cheney to not want to take this too seriously. And they didn't. So the program really didn't move until the Clinton administration arrived. And there, Bill Perry was the deputy secretary. And Secretary Perry made it very clear that he wanted this program to move, and he would find the funds. And so it was Bill Perry that took money from hither and yon to put into my budget for implementation of the program. And as I watched the skill with which he found those funds, I learned a lot. Now, I don't want to say that I reported to Secretary Perry. His interest was intense. Mm-hmm. And we met with him on at least a biweekly basis. But in between us was the undersecretary, John Deutsch, also a good friend of mine, also MIT. And John was very much a player in how we did these things, as was on the policy side Ashton Carter, now a professor at Harvard, who was the policy guy. But we formed a tight-knit team. And it says something about Secretary Perry that he began forming that team clearly 20 years ago when he left the Carter administration. Mm. So that a lot of the bureaucratic jungle that you quite properly allude to had been cleared away by the fact that this was a hard-working team that had known each other for 20 years, and we really knew what we wanted to do, so that things weren't as bad as they should have been, given that there was only authorized money without real money being appropriated. That changed, of course, and we now have appropriated money for that.
And what were the arguments within the bureaucracy, within the Congress, against the implementation of this program? Because that must have been something you had to deal with.
Well, let's take a good example, defense conversion. We wanted money. In fact, we spent money. I spent money. I signed contracts to convert Russian arms makers to builders of commercial goods. And that's all well and good. That's a noble cause. The Russian economy needed it. Very nice. But I had to testify before the Congress. And many of these congressmen were in districts where their defense industries were not doing well. Mm-hmm. And they would say, Dr. Mm-hmm. Smith, before you start spending money over there in Russia, I want to see our defense industries converted. And I'm not going to give you a penny until you do thus and so. And that would occur over and over again. In fact, we finally lost that one. We discontinued our defense conversion. But it was understandable parochial interests, primarily on the Hill, that made it difficult on the American side to carry out what was we thought was and was a noble cause. On the Russian side, it's a, as you know, it was a helter-skelter time. And if the politics of Washington are difficult to understand, try the politics of Russia following the downfall of the Soviet Union. I was aided enormously there by a couple things. One, as a graduate student, I had read an awful lot of Russian literature. And I had also listened to a lot of Russian music. In fact, our first child was named after the heroine of War and Peace, so her name was Natalia. Well, if you're in a difficult negotiation with the Russians and you have a first-class interpreter, which was one of the great benefits, my interpreter would say, Dr. Smith, tell them about Natalia. So I would explain why we named our daughter after Natalia Rostov. And you could see the tension falling. So that in trying to find my way around the Russian bureaucracy to find out who could make decisions, and to come back to one of your early themes, that's where my business experience paid off. In business, we're always looking for Charlie Kansai. Who could really make a deal? And it wasn't easy in Russia. Mm-hmm. But eventually, we figured out who could make a deal. And so it took a nice acceptance on the part of the Russian of my genuine interest in Russian culture, an able interpreter. I mean, this was a woman who, on her way to Moscow, if I were doing dismantlement of chemical weapons, she would be up all night reading a chemical engineering dictionary just to make sure she had every possible word. Well, with that kind of support, and I had excellent support, as I said, a love of Russian culture and a sense of where is Charlie Kansine, we eventually, I know that we found the right people, wrote the right contracts, and carry out the right programs.
You make mention in one of your talks of a general on the other side who,
yes,
who was a key, he was head, I think, of the 10th Command structure.
It's called the 12th GUMO, 12th Main Directorate. Yeah. All nuclear weapons that were not on alert were his responsibility.
His name was?
General Maslin.
Maslin, yeah.
Truly a Weltfolk in the German sense. Yes, he proved to be not only Charlie Kansine, but a man of real courage who made decisions that must have been very difficult to defend to his superiors. But we've got to know each other. He's a very forceful gentleman and also very cultured. Mm-hmm. The Russians treated me to many things, a tour of the Battle of Borodino because of its place in War and Peace. I responded by having General Maslin tour the French Impressionist Gallery in the National Gallery in Washington because, as a young man, he grew up in St. Petersburg and knew a lot about the Hermitage and happened to like French Impressionists. Mm-hmm. It was very clear that General Maslin knew at least as much about French Impressionist painting as the curator for French Impressionists. And the curator himself is a good friend of mine. We correspond because he was recently awarded the Chevalier of the Légion d'honneur, which gave me another opportunity to remind him of this momentous evening when the conversation shifted from the curator leading the discussion to General Maslin for convening the discussion. Well, when you find a man who has courage, who is well-placed, who has the responsibility and willing to sign contracts and happens to be a culture gentleman decides,
it works.
It's pretty easy to kind of do. It works.
It's interesting because you're making an interesting point about both the United States and the Soviet Union. One, the superpower that won; the other, the superpower become a great power. And you're saying that personality, in the case of Perry, for example, or in the case of this general, that men committed, smart men committed to a goal, could move the system, two very different systems. Is that fair?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it is amazing that it comes down to just a few individuals.
Yeah.
Guess I can't say more than that.
Yeah. Now, but this work was embedded in structures that, no matter how ideal the personalities were you were working with, created difficulties. Concerns on the Russian side about intelligence. Concerns right. about, or not even knowing what the Russian law was. So a whole array of things. The whole problem of Russian pride, you know, essentially being assisted by the winner in dismantling the source of your great power. So all of these were there.
That's right, in spades. In fact, some of the good work we've done, you and I together, here on the Berkeley campus since returning, has been to show that the Russians could make a decision legally to consolidate how they store their nuclear weapons. And we showed that, in fact, the Prime Minister could make that decision. And we happened to predict that he would, and he did. But that was another case of finding the right person in the right place mm-hmm. with the necessary courage and power to make the right decision. On my side, of course, it was much easier. It's a truism that what every official in government wants is simply a few words. The words are, the president wants. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, if people believe you, things happen. Well, in the Pentagon, I would say Secretary Perry wants. Mm-hmm. And the secretary would always back me up. And they would see that I was always on the secretary's calendar. So that any time I said I wanted something, people had to think twice before they say no, because who knows? Maybe the secretary really does want this done. So the hierarchical nature, where the top of the hierarchy chooses to focus on certain areas, makes those areas much easier than anything else.
So we can say the fall of the Soviet Union created your agenda for the first phase of your recent career.
That's right.
And now 9/11 creates the agenda for the second phase. And both of these problems, in a way, are linked, because it's really about cleaning up the unintended consequences of decisions made in an earlier phase. 9/11, we suddenly realized that we could be attacked on the homeland by disciplined, fanatically driven terrorists. And immediately the first fear becomes, well, what if they could get a hold of some form of a nuclear device, whether a dirty bomb or whatever? And that presents your new agenda. Is that correct?
That's very well stated. Would that I could do it as well myself.
And so what is, can you state for us the entree points into this problem, that because I, you know, we've listened to you talk about what you've been doing. We have a sense that we have to bring different sectors together. There has to be interdisciplinary study in order to identify the problem. And then, of course, hopefully down the road, something will be done about it. Talk with us a little about how you're doing that now.
Well, the problems get as complex as you have laid out. I can find no better way than a scenario to focus our thoughts, our being the various members of the faculty who join me in projects of this type. Now, that's not to say that we think the scenario is going to occur. It's strictly a way of focusing one's capabilities. So in this case, we do fear loose nukes in Russia, or probably equally likely just loose fissile material. And we want to take that danger and see if we can focus what we, the United States, or we, the Russians, or we, the world community, should be doing to make sure that fanatics do not get their hands on fissile material, or worse yet, a weapon, and detonate it in a major city, whether it's an American or European or Asian. So we have been here at Berkeley following these scenarios, and in this case we actually decided to take a step further and propose that the fanatics who exist in Russia, or let's say more appropriately on the southern border where there's a strong Islamic strain, could get a weapon, and rather than transport it across international boundaries where there's some risk it could be detected. And given the hatred that the Chechens, at least the extreme Chechens, have shown at Beslan and in Moscow itself, mass murder does not seem incredible. So we posited that the Chechens would set off a nuclear device near the Kremlin and ask ourselves not only what would happen, which is challenging in itself, but also what should we do now to make sure that the things we most fear do not happen. This is not an easy problem, because for a lot of reasons. First of all, human beings don't like to think about unpleasant events.
Thinking the unthinkable is what I guess in the earlier period.
That's right, and this is a takeoff on Herman Kahn.
Yeah,
I've asked my colleagues to think about the unthinkable, and they have done a very fine job. So that, to be fair to the administration, there's very little work being done on what do we do if. A lot of energy is being expended on making sure it doesn't happen. And that's wise. But some effort has to go into thinking the unthinkable, denying the denial, and universities, particularly broad-based universities like Berkeley, are just the ideal place to carry on work like that. Furthermore, the Defense Department recognizes that and has sponsored this kind of work. Mm-hmm. And I think they're very pleased with their product.
And two particular problems, that let's briefly just touch on this to give our audience of a feel, and I'm going to give a popular interpretation. One is the CSI problem. There's a very popular show called Crime Scene Investigation, and that is, and the analogy here would be nuclear forensics. Namely, if a device were to go off, what is the evidence about who did it, which is an important piece of information about how our policymakers or Russian policymakers should respond? Touch on that.
That's a very fine question. Let me give a historical context. We first learned that the Russians had exploded a nuclear device by virtue of flying aircraft on the eastern border of the Soviet Union and just picking up minute amounts of the debris from that first shot. But it was enough to convince Mr. Truman, correctly, that indeed the Russians now had an atomic device. Well, that gives you some feeling for what we can learn from the debris from a nuclear weapon. So that if a bomb went off in the United States, we clearly have the ability to decide within a day or two that it was a uranium device, a plutonium device, whether it was a sophisticated device, or whether it was homemade, so to speak. That's important information. But it goes further than that. If one has the library by which the plutonium has been produced, the reactors, the separation process, or the techniques that have been used to enrich the uranium, if one knows those things, and there are telltale isotopic ratios, these are various forms of the key nuclei that result from separation or enrichment, and of course the debris afterwards. One can possibly say, this weapon came from Arsenal X. Now, that can be extremely important. Let's take the scenario that I posited regarding an explosion in Moscow. Certainly, there's a real possibility that the Russians could conclude that was an American device. If there were a bilateral Russian-American team with access to the libraries mm-hmm. that we've been discussing, who could say in a matter of days that no, that's not an American device, and in fact it's not a Russian device. That's extremely important when one can retaliate with nuclear weapons. So we really would like to, we've come up with this idea. It's not new, but it's an idea that really has to be pushed forward. The idea of nuclear forensics is not new. The idea of bilateral or multilateral forensics, that's new, and that's going to be very, very difficult because all countries that have developed nuclear weapons treat that information as sacrosanct. How they go about producing material, how they do the designs, that's going to be a hard, hard argument to make. But thanks to support from the Defense Department and the good people here at Berkeley and the Livermore Laboratory and the Sandia Laboratory, I think we're prepared to make some very potent recommendations on how to go about it.
A second problem that you're working on, and I want to again give our audience a feel for this problem, is really the problem, God forbid, if a device were to go off here, Russia, somewhere else, the whole issue of evacuation and thinking about the possibilities there, the choices before decision makers. And again, we can actually refer to a recent experience, namely what comes to mind, since I'm from Galveston, Texas, is the evacuation of Houston,
yes.
Which the anticipation of a storm that didn't materialize in Houston nonetheless led to a flight from the city, which became a public official's nightmare, both for the people who run the government in Houston and Texas, but also officials nationally watching this. Mm-hmm. And so talk a little about that, because again, it's kind of an interdisciplinary approach to thinking about problems. Well, we'd rather not think about them, but we really have to.
Well, first of all, to give you a personal view, our daughter and her family moved to Houston 2 weeks before Hurricane Rita hit. Mm-hmm. And I finally made the decision to evacuate them. Southwest still
this
had...
This was Rita.
Rita. And Southwest Airlines had a few seats left, and so we got our family out. But it certainly drove home to me personally the fears of everyone of this, what was then a Category 5 hurricane. You're quite right, it was downgraded by the time it hit Houston, but no one knew that at the time. Now consider, that is something that has been tracked for days. We all knew where Rita was. We had a pretty good idea where it was going. We had the experience of Katrina to show how devastating it could be. You might say there were warning signs everywhere. Now let's think about a nuclear explosion. There's no indication whatsoever until there's a blinding flash of light, the proverbial mushroom cloud, and worse yet, if the device has exploded on the ground, then there is all the debris from the weapon and the activated soil, concrete, glass that's around it. And it is a big black plume, and it will move in whatever direction the wind is moving. Those people who are in suburban housing had better move, because exposure to that plume for short periods of time, many minutes to an hour, could be lethal. Those people have to move. But if we go back now to the Houston experience, everybody is going to be scared to death. And everybody will want to move, in which case nobody can move, which is what Houston showed. That means then that those in the plume will suffer radiation death. And I don't mean cancer 30 years from now. I mean death that day. So we have formulated a problem which we call selective evacuation. And your guest a few days ago, Professor Smelzer, has been a great leader in this. But it's quite simple. Those who will be in the plume should move, and those that will not be in the plume are actually rather safe. to seek shelter. The deeper, the better. Unfortunately, duct tape would be a good idea to seal windows and things like that. And that has to, one has to shelter oneself for periods of many hours, not many days. And so it is not the Armageddon that we think of in the nuclear exchange of the Cold War. This is one single nuclear weapon which will have death and devastation, but only for perhaps a mile around the weapon. And then we fear this plume, and there, if we do it right and move the people who are in it and keep the other people sheltered, the number of fatalities goes way, way, way down. So it's a very humanitarian undertaking, but it's fraught with the technology problems of how do you predict which way it's going to go. More important, the psychological problems. How do you convince people to stay put with a nuclear explosion going off? Or maybe equally different, how do you make people move? Particularly since you may not have the communication system that you would like to have. There are legal aspects here. There are political science aspects. Who's in charge? There are organizational questions. It's one of those areas where the interdisciplinary nature of Berkeley and its surrounding national laboratories is just ideal for us to look at. Furthermore, better to have a university look at this terrible problem than for the government to do it, because the government then will be telling the people they honestly fear it's going to happen. There's, as we call it, there's plausible denial when a university and its academic thinkers take it on. But we're undertaking this project for the very reasons that you and I have been discussing.
One final question, Harold, because looking back at all we've talked about in your career, I think it's fair to say that you carry an element of hope even as you think about all these unthinkable possibilities, and it's really by applying rationality in an organized context that you think one makes a difference.
Yes, if you think things through, I'm quite positive we will do more than survive. I mean, we can be a very healthy society as far into the future as I can look. But you're absolutely right, Harry. What one can find on a campus like this is a group of people who are willing to sit down, think hard, write clearly what we have concluded, and what's equally difficult, take that message to the right people where decisions can be made. It's hard work, but what else is there to do?
On that positive note, Harold, I want to thank you very much for coming back to the campus to be at the School of Public Policy, and thank you for being on our program today. Thank you.
It is my pleasure. Very good questions, Harry. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.